Commentators have been trying to come up with historical parallels for the wave of unrest sweeping Arab nations. Some have compared it to the dramatic upheaval that swept through Europe in 1848. That's right, 1848. Mike Rapport is senior lecturer in history at the University of Stirling in Scotland and author of the book 1848, Year of Revolution.
In 1848, there was a wave of uprisings across Europe, really reaching from Paris to Krakow and from north to south. And it toppled a series of authoritarian or conservative governments. And it brought reformists and liberals to power. And they tried to establish constitutional rule where it didn't exist and civil rights. And in some cases, to try to free their own countries from foreign rule.
We should say that many of these regimes had only been around for 30 years or so, kind of parallel to what's happening right now in parts of the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's true that the regimes which were toppled in 1848 equally had only been around for just over 30 years. They had been established in many cases in 1815 in the wake of the downfall of Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, this isn't true of all of them, but it was certainly true of some of the more notable ones.
Okay. Now, one interesting point here. There was a piece of information technology, not Facebook, that played a role in the spreading of the news then. What was it?
It was the telegraph, which allowed a lot of the news to spread very rapidly from one city to the next. And so the telegraph was actually in many ways responsible for the crisis of confidence which many of these regimes had in facing down the opposition when the revolutionary moment came, because the news traveled so fast and people learned about it quickly as well, and it allowed people to respond to the news of revolutions in other countries very, very quickly. This explains partly why 1848 spread so rapidly. But there was also the steamship. There was also the railway line. In fact, I think maybe the railway is perhaps even more important than the telegraph because it was a much wider network.
So tell us how that worked. Maybe give us a bit of the geography and how the news spread from one regime to another through steamship, railway, and telegraph.
Well, yes. I mean, the epicenters of the revolts in Europe at that time were probably, I mean, definitely Paris, but probably you can also add to that Vienna. But the first revolutions of that year actually took place in Sicily and Naples in southern Italy. And one of the reasons the revolution which began in Palermo spread to Naples in southern Italy was because the news reached Naples via paddle steamer, which I thought was always like a nice little modern touch. It makes the revolutions have a very strongly modern feel about them. And when you compare it to, say, the first big revolution in Europe, the great French Revolution of 1789, where it took 2 weeks for the news to spread of the fall of the Bastille in Paris to northern Italy and a little bit less into Germany, the speed of the news was quite a dramatic change.
And what was the news?
The main one, the really kind of earth-shattering news, was that there was a revolution in Paris. Paris had a revolutionary tradition. People looked to Paris. And so when that happened, when Paris rose up in revolution, a lot of people followed. And the revolutions didn't come out of the blue. I mean, there was a lot of opposition. There was a major economic crisis, of course. I mean, a global or at least a European-wide economic crisis, which, of course, has parallels with today in the Middle East. And so there's a great deal of discontent. A lot of people were frustrated with the limitations of the freedoms they were given by the conservative order. Again, a modern parallel there. And in the end, once you get a revolution in Paris, when people go, right, Paris is rising up, they follow the French example and rise up. In Vienna as well. Vienna is in many ways the epicenter. Vienna, the uprising in Vienna, sparks insurrections in the Austrian-ruled parts of Europe, such as northern Italy.
Well, what were people's lives like then? What kind of revolution were they calling for and why?
Now, there were two types, really. There were the liberals, the moderates, if you like, many of them middle class or aristocratic, who simply wanted political change with civil rights. Not necessarily even democracy, but, say, a constitutional monarchy with limited parliamentary government. But you also had radicals who wanted radical social reform, a reorganization of labor relations, for example. And in many cases, in parts of Central Europe, remember, serfdom still existed, or a form of servitude for the peasants still existed. They wanted to abolish that. And on that, the moderates agreed. But they certainly didn't want to push the revolution towards, say, a socialist or social democratic type of regime, which the radicals wanted. And here again, one could argue that there are parallels. On the streets of Cairo, we saw secular, middle-class students and professionals out on the streets. But then, more recently, you've seen more radical Islamic militants coming out as well and joining the protests too. And there's the potential for a great deal of tension between the two wings of the opposition there. And that's exactly what happened in 1848.
These are some of the similarities. What are some of the differences?
Well, one of the differences I hope we see is the international context. I mean, in the end, one of the big differences I hope emerges is that you don't get bloodshed, civil war in these countries. That hasn't happened yet. And it's partly because one of the differences is the response of the authorities.
And you're saying that there was massive bloodshed back in 1848.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. First of all, in the initial wave of revolutions in Paris, in Berlin, in Vienna, in Milan. But it's partly because in those cities, the authorities tried, less so in Vienna, but they tried to crush the insurrection using lethal force. And here, of course, the big difference between what's going on there and in Cairo now is that the army seemed to be playing some kind of waiting game, or indeed might be wondering whether they should side with the demonstrators, and so have been restrained. I mean, people have been killed, but they have not been deployed in the kind of overwhelming, crushing force which the conservative order tried to do in 1848 in many cities in Europe.
It's interesting to note that most of the 1848 revolutions failed throughout Europe, but would you say that they had a lasting legacy?
I think they did. I mean, first of all, serfdom was abolished in Central and Eastern Europe where it had existed, and that prepared the way for a lot of peasants to become fully-fledged citizens of modern nation states. The second thing is that some states, although the revolutions are crushed, do emerge and remain as constitutional monarchies. And these become the nucleus, the kernels of the United States of Germany and of Italy later on in the 19th century. And what's more, in France, for example, 1848 introduces universal male suffrage on an almost permanent basis. Another legacy, the people in general enter politics on a scale unprecedented, and the peasantry as well. I mean, some peasants in some countries actually get elected to parliament, which is unprecedented in European history. But this is what happens.
Mike Rapport is senior lecturer in history at the University of Stirling in Scotland, author of the book 1848, Year of Revolution. Thanks for telling us about that year.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.